I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. If you can believe your eyes and ears, your screens, your Twitter feed, this is your mind, your country, our inner mumblings, our very public American life on Trump. It sounds like this.
With the exception of the late, great Abraham Lincoln, I can be more presidential than any president that's ever held this office, that I can tell you.
The president's mental health is in doubt here and around the world for the most inexplicable statements any president has ever made.
President Trump spoke before a small crowd of Boy Scouts today. That is some crowd.
That tweet is enough to impeach the president of the United States.
That means Michael Pence becomes president, and that is better.
Everyone on their feet.
We will find you. We will arrest you. We will jail you. And we will deport you.
You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab him by the I can do anything.
I turn on the TV, open the newspapers, and I see stories of chaos. Chaos. Yet it is the exact opposite.
You know, one of the things I cannot stand about this town is the backstabbing that goes on here, okay? Where I grew up, in the neighborhood I'm from, we're front stabbers.
This administration is running like a fine-tuned machine.
There is no following this story, this confounding condition, this inescapable event called Trump. So this hour, in a sort of six-month checkup, we're just taking impressions from near and far. What does it mean for a country, a culture, for our sleep cycles, our sanity, to be on Trump for so long now? And what is it doing to us, alone or together? Emmett Renson gets us started. He's a young counter-commentator, still in his 20s. His vision of the new culture war jumped off the page of the Los Angeles Review of Books. It's a fight, he says, in our collective soul between the raging id, that is, the fantasy desires of the new power center, and the blathering superego, the no impulse, coming out of the technocratic center that was.
It's shocking, and it's shocking on a number of levels. There's just sort of an immediate level, you know, oh my God, how is this guy the president? You know, I have these like horrifying visions where, God forbid, like India and Pakistan get into a shooting war and Trump's White House is called upon to resolve that crisis and we all die in a nuclear apocalypse. But sort of beyond that immediate scariness of it, I think a couple of things happened. Like the liberal technocrats really didn't believe it could happen. And they didn't believe it could happen for the same reasons a lot of people did. You know, polling suggested it was inconceivable. It sort of felt inconceivable. But also for, I think, deeper reasons. The Clinton campaign, I think, basically believed it was going to win because it predicted that it was going to win. And the whole thing the Clinton campaign was selling, and in a larger sense, the whole thing the Democratic Party is selling, is competence and expertise. Before anything else, before the ACA, before kinder social policy, the whole idea is that they're the responsible ones. They're the competent ones. They're the managers. And if that's what you're selling and you say, we're definitely going to win this election because we have the best models and the best charts and we got Robbie Mook in there with the best computers we could buy running all the numbers. And, you know, who cares what those union guys in Michigan say about what's happening on the ground? They're just wrong. It's really shocking when the whole basis of your self-identity is just sort of like blasted away by history. And the reactions to that have been, you know, variously like unhelpful and troubling, like from the sort of singular focus on Russian interference to a sort of weird, spiteful condescension you see sometimes. Like, I think it was Marcos, the Daily Kos founder, who was basically gloating about the fact that like poor Trump voters were going to lose their health insurance. You know, obviously gleeful class spite is really the sign of a good and enlightened liberal. Or stuff like, you know, you go on Twitter or something and every time the president tweets, I mean, people will just be appalled that he uses Twitter to communicate things to the public. But every time he tweets, these same sort of respectable technocrats who are just appalled by the fact that he does it just reply hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And it's just like one very cynical ploy for followers, but also, you know, it's like they all imagine themselves sitting there in the chambers at the height of McCarthyism, you know, demanding if the president has no shame and no dignity. I swear to God, this is true. I took a nap the other day and I had a dream in which every time the president tweeted, the top reply was Aaron Sorkin just doing a long thread that was a new script for a new episode of The Newsroom he hadn't written yet. I mean, the word I like to use for them is like radical Sorkinism. And you can imagine it, like, you know, it's all the guys from the West Wing just melting down because they can't believe that this undignified guy is in the office. And if only President Bartlet could give like a really good talking to him, everyone would sort of come back to their senses. And it's not that their sense that like Trump is a vulgar maniac is wrong. Like, of course, Trump is a vulgar maniac and a lunatic. But the corrective impulse, that the impulse is corrective, not combative. The idea is you can just kind of chide everyone back into place. I mean, that's the superego stuff.
Explain how the superego works.
The concepts are pretty straightforward, right? I mean, in the basic original schema, right, you have your ego, which is, you know, your sort of conscious mind, your decision-making mind. You have your id, which is, you know, the nebulous sea of your desires and wants and repressed impulses. And your superego kind of develops as you age. It's the part of your brain that has internalized all outside instruction. You know, when you're really young, it's your parents, you know, yeah, shaking the finger, or the priest or whoever, who's, you know, sort of dole out reward and punishment in response to you behaving either the way they want you to or the way they don't. But it's essential to keep in mind that what the superego thinks is good or bad doesn't come from some magic access to the moral, you know, vision of God or something. It comes from what it's absorbed as sort of conventional wisdom and proper, you know, civility and behavioral ethics. So you see that with the sort of the blathering superego, the liberal superego, its inability to sort of believe that the world is really changing in a way that it can't go back.
Right. Who do you picture playing the role of the superego in this world? Put a name on it, or an institution, a person.
Oh, I don't think there's any particular institution or person. I mean, it's the giant complex that runs from, like, you know, the Democratic Party to Democratic Party affiliated think tanks to, you know, the respectable members of the Republican Party. So, you know, you're like David Frums and you're Bill Kristol's, these sort of never Trump guys who I think aren't really so like offended by Trump. It's a collective of human beings who have absorbed and internalized very deeply this whole notion of like, what is politics? What are adult politics? Like, what are the standards of behavior? What can win? What can't win? How are you supposed to behave? And they're watching that just get blown up in a and I think in a way that's horrifying. And so it starts to break down.
Emmett, go back to the beginning. What do you take to be the effect of 6 months of Trumpism? You're calling it sort of a runaway id in power. What's the effect on our heads, on our lives, on our country, on our citizenship?
There's sort of two groups to look at here. One are the people who have always been hurt by American politics, people who have always been poor, who have always been under threat of some kind. A medical disaster leads to bankruptcy. They are deported. You know, those sorts of people for whom this living in the United States and, you know, it's so pervasive that it almost feels like a fact of nature, but you're sort of constantly under assault. And for those people, 6 months of Trump, it's worse. It's an intensification. You know, ICE is unshackled now and has started to behave, you know, in sort of variously depraved ways. It's worse, but it's the same thing as always, but more.
Interesting.
Then you got to look at the superego, the people who are sort of traditionally been in charge. I really think 6 months of Trump has broken everyone's brain. I feel like my brain is broken half of the time. Even this week, people joke about how there's just like kind of too much news and it's too baffling. It's intense and it's sort of funny on some level, but the more serious way to think about it is, you know, I remember a few months ago, Andrew Sullivan, the, you know, sort of famous writer, and he's a Republican, but a sort of drifting liberally, he's respected, he's considered a smart guy.
The war blogger in the early days of Iraq.
Yeah. Yeah. And he wrote a piece in which he basically said that the real tragedy of the Trump administration was that it used to be this nice luxury of living in a democracy that, you know, you could think about politics when it was time to vote or if you cared to think about politics as he did. But the nice thing about living in an advanced country in a democracy was that you got to like live in some sphere sort of away from politics most of the time. You just got to live your life. And that's really revealing because most people who are actually subject to like our economy, to our carceral state, to our sort of broken healthcare, there is no place they get to live where they're not subject to the whims of politics. Their whole lives are dominated by terrible political and economically unjust decisions. What he meant was people like him, and frankly, probably people like you and I, for many of us who do live in this very sort of rarefied, luxurious space where we could sort of not think about politics if we didn't want to. I mean, you're not going to, even under Trump, you're not going to be deported by ICE agents. You know, you're not going to go totally bankrupt because you get sick. But it's so outlandish and so unreasonable, and the sort of pitch and intensity of American politics has become so sort of frantic that you are sort of forced to live in this constant state of anxiety and panic and stress that, frankly, most people live in all of the time anyway. It's just that if you've lived most of your life not having to deal with that, it's sort of a shock when it happens. It's not, oh, well, that's how the world is. It just sucks. It's, oh, my God, this sucks all of a sudden. And that's really shocking. It's one of the crack-ups of the superego is this. It is breaking people's brains.
Breaking people's brains. Explain, though, what is it that hurts the most? That we've been reduced to children, that we've been pushed off the field, or that we're not maybe – that our righteousness isn't taken seriously anymore?
Well, I would imagine that that hurts for people who are very invested in their sort of technocratic righteousness. And I think for a lot of people, you know, it's only been less than a year, so even since the election. And yeah, I think a lot of people are really just still horribly shocked by it. And the big question to bring this back to the superego thing is eventually that shock and pain and fear and terror has to transform into something. And either it can transform into people saying, you know what, the only way we're going to beat the far right is by really committing to the left, to really committing to a vision of society where everyone is taken care of, where we really commit to fighting fire with fire, but, you know, really standing for something good, admit this is a moral battle and fight that moral battle. That'd be the great outcome. But the alternative is the retreat back into the superego, just, you know, stick your fingers in your ears and say, no, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. Look at the charts. Look at these charts forever. And I see some of that happening already. And that frightens me, that the sort of pain and the hurt of it becomes a retreat back into the safe space of, no, we know best. This isn't normal, and it'll all go back to normal at a certain point. Truth is, it's not going back to normal. And even if it did, normal was a bad deal for most people. So we can't go back to normal. We have to accept that this is normal now, and we want something better. We need something better than this.
Emmett Renson, based now in Iowa City, studied philosophy and wrote plays at the University of Chicago. He'll be back in Chicago this weekend, politicking and writing at the Democratic Socialists Convention. Coming up, The Bitch Doctrine with Laurie Penny and an introduction to the alt-right online with Angela Nagel in Dublin. This is Open Source. The subject is the unavoidable you-know-who, and what a 2-year fixation on a single tragic comic anti-hero is doing to the mind and spirit of the great republic. Laurie Penny is a young English writer who emerged, as Christopher Hitchens did many years ago, as a columnist with The New Statesman in London. She calls herself a feminist and a social justice bard. Her new book is titled The Bitch Doctrine, Essays for Dissenting Adults. We reached her in New York.
Well, look, this is a problem of patriarchy, come on. It's a problem of patriarchy gone horribly, horribly wrong. Patriarchy on nightmare mode is what this is. It didn't start with Trump, of course, but I think it's difficult for a lot of men to understand quite how distressing and disturbing it is to have a guy in that position of power who says things like that, a guy who says, you know, grab them by the pussy, a guy who talks about women's menstruation to put them down on national television, a guy who insults and puts down women on the basis of their appearance. Part of the problem, of course, is that he makes the guy standing just next to him or below him, who is maybe not quite that bad, seem okay. He moves the entire discourse back. And of course, it's not just him, it's also Pence. They're the two faces of modern white American racist patriarchy. There's the kind of the boorish, atheist, grabby sexual predator on one hand, and the hateful religious conservative who views all women as vessels on the other hand. You know, they're not at odds with each other. You know, one of the few things that unites them in terms of moral stance is how they believe that women should behave and be, which is, you know, subservient, quiet, beautiful, silent. And you know, I know a lot of people who are as worried about the prospect of President Pence as they are about Trump. Because Pence is clearly an ideologue, which Trump is not. Trump will say anything to hang on to power. He doesn't believe in anything. He believes in himself. That's it. He's the, you know, the manifestation of the id. Pence actually has an agenda, and it's a terrifying agenda.
Trump is also a bully and loves it. Impulsive, whimsical. I just changed my mind. You're in, you're out, you're fired. How deep does that go, and where does it go from here?
Well, look, there's a culture of bullying that runs right through politics in the global north, and we see it in the UK as well. Trump does it on a much bigger scale and in a much more childish way. But our entire electoral system is set up in this winner-takes-all, beat-the-other-guy system. It's set up as a vicious competition, and it's set up to ensure that bullies win the day if they are charismatic enough. And this is one of the reasons that we need deep and fundamental structural change to how we do politics. Because, you know, what does Trump say when he's challenged on anything? What's his answer to everything is, well, I won, so, you know, anything else doesn't matter because I won. And that's not how politics works. That's not how it should work. Politics isn't something that happens once every 4 or 5 years at the ballot box. It's a continuing process, a process of compromise and change and, you know, work at a community level. And this is a person who clearly doesn't understand that in any way. It doesn't matter to him. All that matters to him is winning and being seen to win.
Laurie, I wonder, do you know the George Carlin Guide to American Culture, a little speech about baseball and football, the differences?
I've heard a little bit about it, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, he is an extreme case of the football personality. It's all about a very violent game, predictable, severe injuries, cheating when necessary, total domination of the atmosphere before the game, during the game, after the game. And, of course, it's the rise of football is the story of our culture in the last 40 years. Spell out, again, some of the extreme guy manifestations in the culture that you see.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that sporting metaphor because, of course, Donald Trump's own sport, the one he's obsessed with, is not football and it's not baseball, it's wrestling. It's televised wrestling. Which is often, you know, it's brutal, it's a one-on-one competition, but it's also all staged, it's all fake, it's all about showmanship and vaudeville and the appearance of bloody violence and huge stakes and kitsch. That's what Trump is. Trump is not a football guy or a baseball guy, he's a pro wrestling guy. You know, honestly, obviously, you know, look, I'm a nerd, I'm British, I don't know a lot about sports apart from what I see on Netflix shows like Glow. Right? So please take this with a pinch of salt here. But it seems like a completely different understanding of what the contest is. And maybe this is the key if we want to extend this metaphor. We still think we're living in a football world, but actually we're living in a TV wrestling world where actually the, you know, the key takeaway from TV wrestling is the game is rigged from the start. Mm. It's the appearance of a competition, but it's not actually a competition because the fix is always in. And Trump doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want to play in any competition which he's unsure of winning.
Imagine the future of culture wars going from here.
Well, look, the culture wars are being fought on new terrain right now. The culture wars at the moment are between people who believe that women and people of color and queer people are people who matter in culture, and people who don't, people who think that quote-unquote identity politics have already gone too far and culture needs to be reclaimed. Because, you know, a lot of the momentum behind the Trump campaign amongst millennials started with Gamergate. It started with the backlash against women and people of color in nerd world, which is obviously a big part of my life. I write about it a lot in my book. And that cultural aspect can't be separated from what's gone on in politics here. But I don't think they're going to win this culture war. And I think one of the things that's going to scupper them in the end is because the stories that they are demanding we see more of, again, are old and boring stories. They're stories that we've heard so many times. White guy saves the world. White guy saves the world on the moon. White guy saves the world in, you know, ancient Egypt. White guy, you know, it's the same thing again and again. The hero's journey, the kind of rugged individualist. Just on a pure narrative level, that is a story that we've heard a lot before, whether it's in movies or fiction. These supposedly new stories where other people get to be heroes are doing so well is because they seem so new, because we haven't heard them for so many years. And I think narrative and good storytelling is one of the things that's going to win the day here.
Repurpose the hero's journey. out of Greek literature, out of our own, out of David Copperfield, out of every novel that we grew up on. Give us the successor narrative.
Well, look, the hero's journey was, the line comes from the guy who wrote the book, The Hero's Journey, which lays out what's meant to be the super myth behind every good story. And it's, you can see it from everything from Star Wars to The Matrix to, you know, a lot of ancient Greek legends to, you know, Dickens, the striving young man often, you know, pursuing a great destiny. And what Joseph Campbell was asked once, where women fit in the hero's journey. And what he said was, and this is an indirect quote, he said, women don't need the hero's journey. Women don't need to be heroes. They just need to realize that they are the place that the hero is trying to get to. I mean, that's so ridiculous, the idea that that women don't need to be the heroes of their own stories. They just have to be a bit part in somebody else's story. And the idea that the only story that ever needs to really be told is this striving singular hero narrative is just, look, apart from anything else, it's so boring.
Laurie, a serious question. What is the chance that this incredible display, unending, of, shall we say, masculine excess is going to change us? And maybe someday, dialectically, for the better.
I think a lot of men right now are looking at the logical conclusion of the stories of masculine power and pride they grew up hearing and identifying with. And a lot of those people are asking themselves whether this is what they really want to be and this is who they really want to follow. So, of course, it is an issue of identity in the end. This is why we say all politics are identity politics, because this is about the politics of white masculinity and what it really means. And I think that there absolutely needs to be new models of modern masculinity, desperately so. But writing those and inventing those models is much more difficult than you'd imagine.
That was the transatlantic feminist writer Laurie Penny. Angela Nagel was born American in Houston of Irish parents, then grew up in Dublin, where she writes for the Irish Times and a host of hot online sites. She is known as an astute tracker of the big trends and the hidden nooks in the borderless online culture. Her new book is called Kill All Normies, Online Culture Wars from 4chan and Tumblr to Trump and the Alt-Right.
In the strict sense, the alt-right is a movement which is essentially a white supremacist movement, or certainly a white separatist movement. They're identitarians. They believe in racial identity as the basis of politics. So in ways, it's pretty standard far-right stuff, because, of course, the far-right have always been separate from sort of mainstream conservatives and often warring with those nearest to them. But what made it different, I guess, was that there was this huge online kind of army of anonymous young people, you know, who were kind of funny and good at creating memes and had their own language, and they were very good at sort of bamboozling mainstream journalists. Some of them would come from a place like 4chan, which is like an image posting board that has created lots of memes and, you know, has been very influential in online culture. 4chan has changed over the years. Anonymous, the kind of hacker collective, came from 4chan. And it was that moment around sort of, you know, the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street, when everyone was talking about hacker politics and networked internet-based politics as this bright new future of activism. It actually ended up being the very style and networked formation or whatever of the far right, actually.
What does Donald Trump owe to 4chan? And what encouragement do they get from him and his election?
They love trolling. I mean, that is the central kind of culture of the whole thing. And he is kind of like an internet troll, right? I mean, they love the fact that he was unapologetic, that he was kind of rude. He hated political correctness. All of that stuff they love. And of course, build the wall, they love that too because of their anti-immigration politics. So they really felt basically that liberals have taken everything over and they're destroying everything. And what you need is somebody unapologetic like Trump to come in and sort of break all the taboos and destroy kind of liberal hegemony. But the significance of them is that for a very long time, the right has not been able to shake off the kind of uncoolness of being on the right. You know what I mean? Like it was always an older age cohort, and the conservative politics of the right, the kind of Christian conservative politics, didn't really have kind of mass appeal, especially for younger people. And it was always a little bit fusty and boring and so on. It made being on the right cool again, possibly for the first time. The formal, politically serious hardcore of the alt-right may be small, but the numbers of teenagers and now particularly guys in their 20s who've gone into college and are having these big wars over free speech and stuff like that on campus, they have been hugely influenced by things like 4chan. And certainly for younger people, it has influenced the very stark division on the question of political correctness. So what you have online is simultaneously a culture on one side which has become ultra sensitive to offense, and at the same time a rival culture which is coming from that Trumpian kind of youthful 4chan-y right, who relish being offensive. It's like the two kind of are becoming more entrenched in response to each other.
Angela, size up the power of something like this outside the internet in terms of their numbers, their ambitions, their money, their coherence. What are we talking about?
Just putting together the numbers isn't quite the right way to look at it, because small numbers of people have changed the world many times.
Sure.
The point is, they have come along at a moment in which liberalism is in crisis, and it's finding it very difficult to sort of defend itself. It's not doing very well at defending itself at the moment. The far right has been there, you know, for a long time, but why now, kind of, you know? So I think it is because of that weakness of liberalism.
Yeah. Angela, outline the new culture war as you see it, including the place of identity politics.
To me, the original culture wars happened in the 60s. Identity politics then was about what became mass movements around feminism, around gay liberation, you know, the civil rights movement and so on. Then there was a kind of reemergence of the culture wars again in the 90s. Susan Faludi called it a backlash, for example, against feminism. And you had Camille Paglia and you had Bill Maher, his show Politically Incorrect and stuff like that. There was a moment of kind of a revived culture wars where there was a lot of kind of like dissident voices more than necessarily voices on the right. But you also then had like Pat Buchanan, and you also had a kind of more confident right that wanted to roll back some of the cultural changes that had happened since the 60s. I think now what you have is a reemergence once again of the culture wars, and it's all the same stuff. It's race, it's gender, it's feminism, political correctness, immigration, and so on. But it has definitely come back to the center of politics in a massive way. And I think the online world has definitely helped that along.
Angela, how is the online version going to be different?
On the right, you are allowed to say anything, right? And that's what makes them, in one way, horrible. Because if you look at their forums, it's just filled with really kind of stomach-churning, dehumanizing, disgusting stuff. But because they have a culture in which everyone's anonymous and everyone's allowed to say the most taboo thing that you can possibly think of, they have been allowed to, I suppose, bash out ideas in a certain way. They're used to the kind of heat of argument. On the left, particularly around cultural and identity issues, it's so impossible to have an open conversation that it has really dulled everyone. And this is why we're not able to defend our ideas, because we're not in the practice of actually having any kind of conversation in which you are allowed to say anything that might conceivably be repackaged as or misinterpreted intentionally as an offensive thing.
The other way this is observed is that the right wing, the Republican Party in general, don't necessarily embrace their loonies, but they have speaking relations with them. The left is embarrassed by their unconventional voices.
We're going to have to find some way to have a culture on the left of open debate and open discussion. If you go back and look at, say, somebody like Gore Vidal, you know, I mean, you know, if Gore Vidal was around now, he would have already been witch hunted out of the left because he would have said something offensive, because he was offensive.
walk us into a new landscape, the culture wars of the new century, your culture on Trump, so to speak.
I think the real fault line is going to be in the coming years between materialists and anti-materialists, essentially. I think it's going to be a war between political movements that see the material factors of life, class and economics and so on, as being of enormous importance and influence, and also basing your political ideas around those things. I mean, for example, the alt-right describe themselves as an identitarian movement. I have heard Richard Spencer say that they're anti-materialists. Their idea is people should be grouped into identity categories and they should fight it out for their patch in those identity categories. The historical moment, I suppose, for the emergence of identity politics in the 60s, it was hugely important and they achieved amazing things. But today, I think the problem is that the left won the culture war and lost the economic war. And I think the emergence of Sanders and Corbyn is an attempt to actually address that.
That was the online speed reader, Angela Nagel in Dublin. Coming up, David Bosworth, our seer in Seattle, writes of the Trump moment that we're looking at the birth of something as big and complex as the birth of modernity in the time of Shakespeare and Cervantes. The future is unforeseeable, he says, but it was made in our time in America. And then a few words from the advice columnist Liza Featherstone. This is Open Source. We asked David Bosworth for the long view of the Trump moment in the history of our culture, our tech, our work. He's a critic who writes novels, too, and he's a celebrated teacher at the University of Washington. As it happened, we found him on an island well off the western shore of the continent.
There's a joke by Lily Tomlin I use. It goes, "We're all in this together by ourselves." The history of human cultures, there's a kind of pivoting between what culture will emphasize which of those two halves, whether we're together or whether we're by ourselves. America is probably the most extreme example of a culture that's been built on the notion of being by ourselves, of being individuals, of being entrepreneurs in the economic field, of being heroically individual in the moral field. And the set of cultural circumstances and economic circumstances and technological circumstances that made that seem logical and right and appropriate is now ending and has been ending really for 100 years since the Electronic Revolution. And we're caught in the midst of this incredibly stressful and confusing period when we are still believing the old myths and moral understandings that we had about the past and who we should be and how we should behave are being undermined by the very economy and technologies we use every day.
You know, in the chaos of this Trump White House, I don't know, it seems like an orgy almost of white guys in contention but exposing themselves in many sorts of ways. You write about a long transition, centuries, from the locked diary of the medieval journal to self-exposure on Facebook, billions of people, each one with average hundreds of friends talking about themselves all the time. Does that set the context of Trumpismo in some way?
Well, he's coming out of that culture, of course, where you only exist if you're in the public sphere. It's a kind of anxiety. There was an internal anxiety of when you were in the locked individualism. Any adaptation to the human condition has its particular kinds of stresses. So there'd be the guilt of the individual or the worry about how one might be perceived or the fear of your privacy being invaded. The astonishing fact to me is how quickly that sense of privacy that's actually necessary for a coherent individualism has been completely decimated by the electronic revolution. Middle school age kids, you know, they're always on their phones. They're always in contact with other people for healthy and unhealthy reasons, whatever. But they're no longer going to have to imagine themselves in my room. Wasn't that a Beach Boys song? You know, that sort of sense of being by yourself. They're not going to be by themselves, at least in the digital sense, ever. And there needs to be, it seems to be a psychological need for ratification, you know, the whole idea of likes online. And that's just a different understanding of who a human being is. It's a radical change from the American tradition.
In the last essay of yours that I've read, David Bosworth, you write about the fundamental reality of togetherness in this society, as human beings maybe, but as Americans now connected, but in a society that still calls itself self-reliant and individualistic. What is that all about?
Right. Well, the original self-understand, the history of that, of course, is the economic circumstances of the American project's invention back in the 17th and 18th centuries. The circumstances were such that people were more independent. You made your living as an individual farmer or as an artisan or as a craftsman. Of course, there were egregious exceptions to that, being slavery. But most people were really independent. And it was also a frontier society where there's a constant open frontier for perhaps 150 years. And the idea people were settling and making new townships and new social arrangements and new economic achievements on their own. That was a reality, as was the reality of print literacy and reading privately to yourself. So the whole sense of that private self was grounded in an actual economic circumstance. So the American Revolution came out of the recognition of what had already been going on, which was like the development of the individualism in America. America was the most literate society in the world probably at that time, and it was also the most economically independent, and then it recognized and sort of woke up to the realization that they really weren't kingly subjects. They were more like independent citizens, and then struggled through the notion of all the work, cultural and personal work, of creating a society that was very different. So the circumstances that were underlying the creation of that society, including the mythology of the lonesome hero, are now gone. But the fact of the matter is, and this is the tragic fact of the human story to some extent, rapid technological progress almost always creates moral and psychological regress.
Spell it out. Progress creates regress in our heads and hearts.
Right, because, well, culture is a slow building process. Good conservative thinking is right about that. You don't create a healthy society or a healthy community or a healthy family situation overnight. And what happens with new technologies, the idea of disruption, often disruption is destruction. Actually, it destroys the intricate web of social relations and understandings and covenants, if you will. They're being undermined by new technologies, new economic circumstances. And it's not easy to get that back together again. The term used in the American Revolution was checks and balances. The idea of society is checks and balances. But when technology starts developing as rapidly as it has been developing, culture doesn't catch up. It's harder for culture to catch up and adapt.
We grew up on the author Christopher Lash, and among other things, his warnings that we live in a culture of narcissism, isolated selves, over-consuming, over-therapized. Bring us up to date on narcissism today in public places, you know, at home in our heads.
Yeah, I want to stress, I'm a fan of Christopher Lash's, but the problem when we start talking about narcissism, it tends to be this blame game where it's a psychological analysis of the individual, whereas Lash was really talking about cultural circumstances that were undermining individualism, in particular the economic disenfranchisement of the individual by large corporations and that sort of nanny state or therapeutic state that was undermining our moral and psychological authorities.
Would you call it a pathology, David?
Yeah, this gets to some of my fundamental thinking. And, in all honesty, I don't have the answers to this, but I feel like even all of our conceptions in every profession, including psychiatry, are based on the liberal modern model of the individual. So when you say so there's a pathology, we're usually talking about individual pathology. So I really think we need to start moving our mind to cultural context, pathological cultural environments or milieus or whatever you want to call them. So, yes, the narcissism that Lash was mentioning has persisted and is damaging, but it always often ends up with a blame game, pointing at this individual as narcissistic or this generation as narcissistic, rather than talking about the cultural conditions which make the illusion of growing up and behaving as responsible, self-reliant individuals more and more impossible.
Fit consumerism. Good old American consumerism, but now in an age of Amazon, you know, you're one stroke away from that purchase. Consumerism as a trap that we love and hate.
Yeah, I. The reality is that we all need, obviously, a certain amount of material possessions to survive. And the reality is that liberal modernity, what has been extraordinarily productive in the gross sense of producing material goods far more efficiently than they once were. But the question is what human beings actually need and what makes human beings, as it were, happy. And consumption alone does not do it. If you asked yourself in 2000, we're a thoughtful individual, what do we need most in the American economy? Someone would have answered, we need to be able to get our wishes come true within 2 hours, which is, I think, the delivery time Amazon now promises for some of its packages. I would have fallen off my chair. Of course, that's not what we need. But that's how the economy is geared. That's the moral compass that's built into our concurrent capitalist system, consumer capitalism. And the idea is to make people buy more and more. The idea is to keep you addicted to your cell phone. The idea is there's no larger sense of human goodness in those conceptions. It's a very narrow focus. And if you take the critique of individualism and apply it to the idea of dimensions of human well-being, it's the same thing. A corporation has one value. It is supposed to make profit. That one value dominates everything else.
David Buzworth, you're a storyteller as well as a wonderful observer. Can you frame the outward chaos of Trump's America as a sort of chapter in a long line of the American project, you call it?
Yeah, well, I think Trump is, I guess I want to call him, he's sort of our id monster. He's the result of probably 40 or 50 years of decadence. I keep on going back about to the late 1980s and 90s and remembering the sort of end zone dancing that was going on in the West as the Soviet Union fell apart. You remember Francis Fukuyama's neoconservative pronunciation of the end of history.
Of course, sure.
History had ended. The good guys had won, the good guys namely being us. And our way of running the world was going to be predominant essentially forever. Other problems would arise, but the basic way of running the world was fine. Our economists at the same time in the early 90s had solved forever the market's boom-bust cycle. And then, of course, was the promise of the digital age, which soon educate the masses, you know, streaming knowledge and prosperity, et cetera, to everyone. It was a kind of giddy boasting. Made me very nervous, because anytime you have people who have a kind of utopian belief system that they pursue, inevitably it ends up with dystopian results. And look what we got, 9/11, two failed wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, the Great Recession, and an internet that's rife with cowardly trolls and fake news and cyber thievery and all the ads. And so Trump is emerging out of that culture. He's very much ours, you know, I'm embarrassed to say. Lotteriomania, casino construction, celebrity stalking, reality television, of course, which really created him. And then the fantastic policies of economic and military dominion that Americans, intellectuals were holding, and pop culture was promulgating. So he's really kind of the final expression of that, and it's a horrifying thing to see, but it's not as if he came out of nowhere.
So history is alive again. I mean, how does the chapter end?
Well, I don't know. My whole intellectual project or work of late bit is trying to make people aware of it, aware of the fact that we're in this. We have the benefit of thinking back and seeing the birth of modernity. That's on the historical record, the late 16th and early 17th century. So we see a period when individualism is being born and all the cultural strife that went through then. So this is a dangerous transitional period, but we can get through it. You know, if you call the mind, the difference between the medieval mind and the modern mind, you had the ritual performance of the morality play was the primary sort of theatrical performance or artistic performance or literary performance. And now it turned into the privately read realistic novel. The foundational story of Genesis was the prevailing notion of where we came from. And then we had Darwin's theory of evolution that replaced it or certainly supplanted it. We had the strict hierarchies and paternalistic duties of feudal economy versus all the contractual licensing and laissez-faire morality of the market, et cetera, et cetera. No one in 1600, including Shakespeare, who was the most prolific mind I know, could have imagined the moral order that was coming. So we can make a new order. It will be a new order. My question is, will that new order be made, the best version of it? And will it be made in America? Because as modernity dies, we're the most modern culture that's ever existed. In this postmodern era, can America reinvent itself as a conscientious postmodern society? And I don't have the answer to that, but I know we have to strive to do it because the change is coming. Change is coming. The technologies we use, and it's not ISIL, it's not China, it's not Russia, it's certainly not Mexican immigrants who are a threat. It's our own technologies have been transforming our lives, and our cultural and economic institutions are changing our lives in ways that require domestication.
Better a good question than a presumptuous answer. You're saying, can we adapt to the post-modernity that we've created?
Right, exactly. And recognize, admit that we're creating it rather than doing the scapegoating that Trump exploited so egregiously to become elected. I mean, that's a dark side of human nature, but we need an explanation for why things are going bad for us. And sometimes there are villains in our world and there are cutthroats in the world, but sometimes they're just scapegoats. We need to blame someone. So what's gone on is this blame game. That's not the real source of our issues and problems, and we need to see that clearly and respond to it thoughtfully.
The book that sold us on David Bosworth is called The Demise of Virtue in Virtual America. His new title is Conscientious Thinking, Making Sense in an Age of Idiot-Savants. And finally, the advice columnist. People write their headaches to Liza Featherstone at The Nation magazine under the heading Asking for a Friend. She was a feminist for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party fight for president last year. This is how she sounds in the time of Trump.
I mean, you know, a few months ago I said to a friend, I'm really worried. Everybody around me is drinking too much, taking too many drugs. All their mental illnesses are coming out. And it is also reflected in my mail. You know, people are really distressed. People are not sleeping. And my friend said, it's Trump. We're all falling apart. And he ordered a third Bloody Mary before lunch. And that's how it is right now. I think it's important for us to understand that for most people, thinking about politics all the time is a really new source of stress. Most people's lives aren't about politics. Most people are, you know, taking their kids to school and getting themselves home from work and trying to pay their bills. And Trump has forced people to pay attention, and they're finding it quite distressing. I mean, the American Psychological Association reports in a study more mental distress on every level. Calls to suicide hotlines are up. I interviewed for my advice column a number of bartenders who said everybody is drinking too much. Much more cutting people off, much more asking people to leave, much more asking people to take their friends home. You know, people are really not handling this very well.
Liza, let me ask, I mean, depression, alienation, even sleeplessness, these are old problems. What does it mean that in this day and age, this year, nobody can talk about them without Donald Trump in the picture somewhere? There's this one unifying figure. It's like a war going on or a plague, but a figure.
Well, I think part of it is, for some people, Trump is actually kind of a re-traumatizing figure. I mean, because let's face it, bullying males with sort of authoritarian personalities aren't a really unusual feature of life. So for a lot of people, I think Trump reminds them of like a hectoring, humiliating father or boss or ex-husband, you know, somebody in their lives who caused them a lot of traumas. And I think to take that a little bit deeper, the feeling that such a person is in charge of your life is, I think, also quite re-traumatizing, especially, again, for people who have had fathers or bosses like that, you know, that, okay, this person is in charge of our relationship with North Korea or the planet's fate. You know, it's like people's own personal trauma on a global, experienced on a global scale.
If I were writing a letter to you,
yes,
one of them would be, I worry that I'm cheapening myself even by looking at the news anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Is this worthy of my time?
You know, this is something I think about myself a lot, and I don't think that you have a responsibility as a citizen to follow all the ridiculous palace drama in the White House. I think that's like not a useful use of our energy. And I think that, in fact, even following it and discussing too much is probably bad for us, not only in terms of our mental health, but actually intellectually. I've noticed lately that I've stopped going on the internet in the evening at all. And, you know, it's better to just read a really well-written novel, and you just feel your brain coming back to life.
Thank you, Liza Featherstone. And speaking of escaping into the arms of a great novel, we are reading and rereading Herman Melville's giant American epic, Moby Dick, this summer, and loving it all anew. Before the summer is out, We're going to open it up on air. So call me Ishmael, please. Keep reading and tell us what you make of the obsessive hunt for the white whale in 2017. Thank you, Emmett Renson, Laurie Penny, Angela Nagel, and David Bosworth. Thanks also to Elizabeth Lash Quinn. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Kevin Doherty. Susan Coyne does our amazing illustrations online. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.